This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Updike is generally acknowledged as one of the most important living American writers. He's won just about all the big literary awards, including the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. His 16 novels include The Rabbit Series, The Centaur, Beck, A Book, The Witches of Eastwick, Memories of the Ford Administration, and Brazil, which was just published. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Updike several times. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're going to feature two interviews with Updike from the 80s and a new interview about his new novel, Brazil. Updike grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, not unlike the setting of his book, Rabbit Run. After graduating from Harvard, he joined the staff of The New Yorker magazine in 1955. Although he left the staff 2 years later, he maintained a close association with the magazine, which continues to publish his book reviews and short stories. Our first interview was recorded in 1988, after the publication of his novel S, which completed his trilogy of books inspired by Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel The Scarlet Letter. In the mid-60s, Updike said that his subject was the American Protestant small-town middle class, and that middles especially interested him. I asked him if that was still true.
Like many things that you've said and had quoted back at you, you sort of wish to move on in a way, and I wouldn't quite phrase it that way. But as a matter of fact, yes, I do still live in a smallish town, and I do still seem to write about people who are somewhat in the middle. But I don't feel it as a cause quite the way I did. I write about more or less everything I can think of. That is, I stretch my imagination as far as it'll go. And there is, I am kind of stuck in the middle as far as my life goes, and hence my imagination tends to zero in on things which are indeed in the middle. That is, I don't write about the very rich, who I scarcely know, or the very poor, who I don't know very well either.
Do you think your novels are getting less autobiographical as you get older?
I would say, yes, they are slightly. I'm trying to, you know, I am older, and so I've seen more life, and I should be somewhat wiser and should have a certain repertoire of stored images from other lives that I can draw on, and I'm trying to use it. Certainly, yes. Only the innermost essence of my heroine could be called me. The rest is all made up, and indeed her age is nowhere near mine, and in writing about her, I had to sort of rethink what her past would have been. On the other hand, in my own defense, not that you're attacking me, I would say that all of my novels have been somewhat unautobiographical. In every case, there was something that kind of stretched me, and in a way, there was as well as facts and things I had seen and cities I had visited. There was always something which was not true of me. I was never a basketball star like Harry Angstrom. And I was never a black dictator like Eliyahu in The Coup. So always, I think, for a novel, there has to be something out of the autobiographical to excite the author, and one hopes to excite then the reader.
You know, most of your novels have been about people from the middle class, but I think there's something in your life that you've never done in a way that's always a part of the middle class, and that is reporting to work, reporting for a job. You work at The New Yorker for a couple of years back in the mid-50s, but you've been a writer all your life and have been able to make a living from it, which meant that, you know, you never had to go to work.
I've never
out at a job, out in an office or a plant or something like that.
No, exactly so, and I think it is an area of American experience which most people have, and which I have, by my own early and lucky success, have somewhat skipped, and I'm sorry in a way. You know, I'm sorry I did not, unlike Joseph Conrad, ship out and be a Marine captain for many years, because it gave him, when he did, Conrad, sit down to write, it gave him a lot of things to write about. He never was in danger of running out of material. I did have a number of jobs as a teenager, and I did watch my father go off to work every day, and I've lived among commuters for much of my life, so I don't feel entirely locked out. But you're right. I began to write quite early and to get published early, and to some extent it's made me an oddball and a bit to one side of the mainstream of American experience.
Have you ever had the desire to try out a very unusual experience that would take you far away from your life so that you could use it in your writing? I guess what I'm thinking is, between your own writing and all the reading that you do for the books that you review, you really have to be home a lot reading and writing.
I'm home a fair amount and do enjoy trips and have taken a number of them with the idea of expanding my horizons and perhaps leading me to some new room of reality. Africa was the main trip I took. I've been there a couple times, and
you've written about it. I've written about it.
I finally used it both in a few short stories and also in a novel called The Coup. So that was one place that did seem exotic and interesting to me, and I wanted to get there, and I did get there, and I did write about it. Every writer has to find some balance, surely, between being at home and doing the work, and getting out and living and seeing the world. And I've maybe stuck to my desk more than most, but plan in the future to get away a bit. Also, I think we have to just to let us know, let ourselves know that there's more to the world than our desk and our window out.
You've extolled accuracy in writing, accuracy in describing the details of objects and settings and of people and their lives. Why is that kind of detail so important?
Well, I find that the main charge, let's call it, that I get out of writing is when I feel I've gotten something down accurately. And the main bliss, whether I read Henry Greene or Nabokov or Proust or Tolstoy, is the sense that they've described precisely a certain moment of experience, whether it's a dress or a chair or how a person's face looks, that really the literary art is a parasitic one and that its energy comes from the energy of the real. And so accuracy is one way of describing the close approximation to the real that we all sort of live for. There's other kinds of accuracy, of course. There is the larger attempt to, in the shape of your novels, to give something of the texture and the ambiguity of life itself, which makes perhaps for novels that don't end as conclusively and as satisfyingly as 19th century novels did. But I think it's our fate as 20th century people to live with ambiguity, and so I've tried to make my books in some sense reflect the ambiguity as it exists.
Do you think that great novels have more to do with perfect pitch than they do with great stories or great themes?
I think the storytelling instinct has to be part of the writer's equipment, and that in the end, the novels that we treasure as classics are those which tell a pretty solid story. And it's The Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick and Huckleberry Finn, to name three American classics, all have a strong storyline that you can retain in your mind. So I would say that this is one piece and maybe the main piece of the puzzle, but having the story in your mind, then I think it's the sentence-to-sentence pleasures, the little surprises of a surprising style, of an acute style, and also the way things happen one after the other that makes a book interesting to read page to page. So that you try to do both things. You try to have the page to page interestingness, that any page of a novel could be ripped out and read as kind of a poem. That plus the fact that when the book is closed, some kind of whole image will be in your mind and please you, or at least, that in some ways your mind will have been changed by the book.
You review a lot of books, and you once wrote that when you review a book, you should review the book and not the writer's reputation. With the reputation that you have as a great American writer, do you find that it's frequently your reputation and not your latest book that gets reviewed?
I feel that less lately than formerly. I did feel as though a number of critics had appointed themselves when they sat down with a new book of mine to rectify what they felt to be was my inflated reputation. And so that the book at hand was not really given a chance, but made a kind of weapon in the general attempt to bring me down to size. I've tried to avoid doing that to other other writers. And I must say, and maybe I should knock on wood, is that the last couple books of mine have been reviewed in, I think, a basically fair and attentive way. And all a writer can ask, really, is that the reviewer read the book and say what he thinks about it instead of trying to readjust the American literary scene by means of this book review.
Does the critic in you ever threaten to stifle the novelist in you?
Yes, all the time he threatens to do that, and I kind of sidled into reviewing. I never really set out to be a critic, and my mother didn't raise me to be a critic, but in the 60s it seemed a convenient and nice thing to do. I had a number of authors who I was enthusiastic about, and I wanted to share my enthusiasm with the reader, and so it's gone now for 30 years. And I've reviewed a lot of books and would like to review less in the future than I have in the past. But yeah, it's not good to think very critically when you're trying to write because...
Well, I should think you'd be afraid to write. Do you
know
what I mean?
Yes.
Because you're saying, this could be better. There must be a better word than this.
Any sentence could be stifled by the critic in one if you allow him to get the upper hand. But by and large, and keeping in mind that I am a little wary of the critic in me, I think once you start to try to put images and words of dialogue together, that in some way the imaginary world takes over and mercifully shuts out all these harassing critical thoughts that you might otherwise entertain.
My guest is John Updike. You wrote a satire of the literary life called Beck, a Book, one of your novels. And the literary figure who you write about in there is a Jewish novelist. And I wonder if you felt that when you were coming of age that many of your peers who were coming of age as writers were Jewish.
They were, and they are collectively and one by one the chief glory of post-war American literature. It has been a Jewish and urban. I'm Protestant and kind of a country boy, so I did feel that occasionally I was chastised for writing out of such an unfashionable corner of American experience. But I persevered because it was the only corner I had, and who knows what went into the creation of Henry Beck. For one thing, a writer, especially as he ages and if he has some success, has experiences which only a writer could have. So it was helpful to me to invent a fictional writer, and I tried to make him as unlike myself as I could. Instead of a father of four, he's an unwed and bachelor, and he is Jewish and urban, which is in a way something I would like to be.
Jewish and urban?
Yes, I think it'd be nice and kind of lively and a lot of fun, as I imagined it, really, although Beck's life isn't all fun. It's been fun for me to try to imagine myself into the skin and the mind of Henry Beck.
You feel that you missed out on something because you don't have, you know, a kind of obvious ethnic heritage, because WASPs in this country are not assumed to have, you know, the kind of like ethnic sense of past that, say, Jews do. Do you know what I'm talking about?
You don't have a subject quite in the way that the Jewish writers of a certain transitional generation did. It's true. And I was raised in a town that did not have much ethnic self-awareness because basically it was all Protestant, all white, all Gentile. On the other hand, it was in Pennsylvania. We had a sharp sense of ourselves as Pennsylvanians, and there was a feeling that there was something here, that we did have an identity. I don't feel exactly that, you know, it's like water. It's more like milk. That is, there is a color, even if it's white, and even if the milk is a little stale now in the glass. So, you know, I think any life has in it enough material, enough points of departure to fuel a writer's career, and that we shouldn't worry about what we're not, but to try to focus on what we are and what we do know.
I want to talk with you more about your writing and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer John Updike. His new novel is titled S. This is Fresh Air. Writer John Updike is my guest. You grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania where I'm sure there wasn't a big writer's community.
to say the least.
Did writers seem somewhat magical to you growing up away from writers and away from the publishing world?
Yes, the whole world seemed magical. There was, however, my mother, who was trying to be a writer, so that the basic tools of writing, that is, the typewriter and the paper and the manila envelopes, were all in the house, and I used to watch her type and used to watch her send the things off and hope for the best. And eventually she did get published, although perhaps never as much as her gifts deserved. So that there was my mother, there was some literary activity in the nearby city of Reading, and we're talking about an eastern area, basically, which was only a train ride from New York City. So although it seemed quite magical and distant, it was not as distant and magical as it might have seemed to a boy, say, from Alaska or Nevada.
Your father was a math teacher in your high school, and I believe you even had classes with him. You know, most of us don't get to see, most of us as children never got to judge our fathers at the work that they did, because the work that they did was far away from where we were, and what did we know about it? You know, what did we know about their professions or their factories or whatever? But all students evaluate their teachers, so you knew your father in a kind of different level than most of us know ours?
It was a strange exposure. Yeah, my father taught to junior high math, and I was his student for not one but 3 years, all those junior high years. Indeed, he was my homeroom teacher for one of those years. And what can I say, except that he made it kind of painless. I was not pressured to behave better than the other children, and he somehow continued to express paternal feelings toward me when I was not in class. And luckily, I was a good student and liked math, so there wasn't really any basic conflict. But yes, it is a strange thing to see your father at work, as it were. And what I got out of it was mostly, well, two things, really. A sense of pride seeing him perform, because I saw him in high school assemblies, and he was the funniest of the teachers and would say things which would make the whole auditorium roar with laughter. And I thought, in my crouching down on my seat, that that's my dad, and was kind of amazed. On the other hand, I did see, especially as he got older, the real struggle that teaching is, and keeping discipline and saying the same things for the 15th year in a row. And so a curious sense of his agony, that is, the agony of the working teacher, was borne in upon me also.
Well, you must have been known at least partially in school as your father's son, since everyone knew who he was and who you were. Was it a relief when you left home to just not be known as your father's son?
I think the pressure on teachers' children, and there were a number in my class, and on ministers' children in a small town, there is a certain pressure or expectation that you will be good. And since I basically was kind of timid and good, it wasn't an inordinate pressure on me, but I both enjoyed the role, kind of. It did give me a tiny bit of celebrity in this small town, and in a way was happy to get out of Shillington into an area where nobody knew me or my father or my grandfather. Yes, it was a kind of a relief.
My guest is writer John Updike. You know, for years I'd really hoped that I'd someday have the opportunity to do an interview with you, but I was very scared of it as well, because you really dislike interviewing. I mean, you dislike being interviewed, and you dislike the form. You've called interviews a form to be loathed. I think of all the people I've ever met, you really have the strongest anti-interview feelings.
And yet I've given my share of interviews,
I know, as you may notice.
And I seem to be giving more and more, too, which just goes to show that these higher principles. But I think what I was objecting to mostly when I made the remark about them being a half-form like maggots and a form to be loathed is that once you've put yourself on record in an interview and you're sort of thinking fast and saying the first thing that pops into your mind, basically anything to fill up the airtime or the reporter's time, it's a little disconcerting when you're younger than I to realize that these remarks, which you toss off, once they're in print, have an equal weight with all the words that you've labored to polish and make come out exactly right. So in some sense, I do resist and resent the tendency of our age to milk people through interviews to get them to betray or to reveal the real whoever, John Updike, let's say, when John Updike has been trying to show the real John Updike in his writing all these years. However, it's like traffic jams and flying in jet planes. It's part of our part of our penance for living in the 20th century.
Well, listen, thanks for doing the interview. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of more questions for you. Do you mind if I quote you one more time?
No, it's fun to hear it.
You've said that an artist of any sort in our society and most others is a privileged person, allowed to stand apart from some of the daily grind, and supposed to be closer to the gods and to have access to the divine sources of tribal well-being. This is quite a responsibility. And I'm not sure if you think that that's an appropriate way of seeing an artist or if you think that that's an absurd way to see artists.
There's been quite a lot said by the classic modernists, Wallace Stevens and James Joyce and others, and Proust also, about the sacred importance of the writer and about their sense that that God being either dead or asleep, that the writer has inherited what once was the priest's function. And this certainly enabled the modernists, that is, this high concept of their importance, to write marvelous stuff. That is, to do anything well, you have to believe in it. And such a creed enabled them to believe enough to devote their lives to writing well. I don't know as I quite subscribe to this elevated notion of the writer's role, but people do look to us to tell the truth in a way that nobody else quite will, not politicians or ministers or sociologists. A writer's job is to, by way of fiction, somehow describe the way we live. And to me, this seems an important task, very worth doing, and I think also to the reading public, it seems, even though they might not articulate it, it seems to them something worth doing also. In a way, what you are doing is you are giving, Pascal said this somewhere, you're giving back people themselves. You are, by describing as best you can the fantasies of your own life, you are showing other people what their lives are like, and in a way, you are giving people life, you're clarifying their life for them. And so this is not an insignificant task, is it?
No, that's a great way of looking at it, too. I want to thank you so very much for speaking with us. Thank you very much for doing the interview.
Thank you very much.
John Updike, recruited in 1988. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.